Welcome to PPM Simplifies. This is a weekly podcast that will help you have a better understanding on environmental regulations and how they relate to your industry. In each episode, we'll talk with experts across various industries who will share their insights with you. This is PPM Simplifies. Hello, this is Todd Perry, and welcome to PPM Simplifies. Today, we've got a little bit of Turn the Table episode. Mr. Zia Tamami of our Baton Rouge office has joined us, and he is going to step in the role of host, and I get to slip into the guest chair and talk about a topic I know a little bit about, a history of underground storage tank regulations. So, Zia, take it away.
Good morning. Good to have you with us this morning. We have Mr. Todd Perry, co-founder of PPM and managing principal of PPM in Monroe office. He's been around for 33 years, extensive experience in groundwater assessment, remediation, managing environmental dispute investigation management, and that's including cost containment, liability assessment, and settling any negotiation related to USDs. Well, Todd, with this incredible 35-year journey of the regulations with USDs, why are USDs regulated? Just give us some overview on that.
Yeah, thanks, Zia. And, you know, it's interesting as the combustible engine was designed, came into prevalence at the turn of the century, early 1900s. You know, gas tanks were very small at that point, and they were literally built, installed on sidewalks, and very few people had automobiles, and they would pull up. And then as time has gone on, we fell in love with the car as a nation, and the gas stations became bigger and bigger, and they developed into convenience stores. And so they went from being maybe a few hundred gallon underground storage tank or even above ground storage tank to literally 10 and 20,000 gallon tanks. And that's a lot of fuel into the subsurface. And as we got into, you know, EPA was formed in the early 70s, an environmental awakening in our nation, we began to realize that sometimes underground storage tank systems leak. And, at first, it was very much a safety thought of we don't need an explosion. And you had a few little examples where you'd have gasoline vapors, build up an area, and you might have a combustible ignite. And, an explosion, and that certainly got people's attention. But up in the Northeast, some groundwater systems began to get contaminated with gasoline, with benzene, which is a known carcinogenic. And it really all broke loose in 1983 when 60 Minutes did an expose on underground storage tanks and drinking water. And from there, that was kind of the lightning point. Regulations began to be developed. And so that's where why they were developed to protect human health and our drinking water. And that's the background where they came from.
Well, that was great. And we're trying to also find out how all these regulations evolved since the implementation. So can I give us a little bit more sort of a background in that area?
Yeah, the first regulations for underground storage tank were promulgated in 1988, and it was a long process. Probably 84 is when they began to work on drafts of the language. It was officially the law of the land in 1988. It was under CERCLA. Underground storage tank regulations were put under CERCLA, and they were basically three areas for underground storage tank system. One, they wanted to monitor for leaks, so leak detection was a very big area of the first set of regulations. Two, they want to look for spill and overfill. So they're looking for when gasoline is delivered, if there is an overfill at the UST system to contain that and to stop those releases. And then you had corrosion protection. Basically, the metal piping of the underground storage tank would begin to corrode and rust. So those are three areas they went after first. And so those were the first regulations, very new to an industry that never had regulations before. Now, on top of that, the law also had to contemplate where there were releases that already occurred, how to address those. And that's where I think a really successful program was developed, you know, by EPA and implemented by the states, which was a motor fuels underground storage tank trust fund. So all the states, to comply with the EPA's new rule, had to develop these motor fuels trust funds. Now, some states did better than other states, but this fund was put there to where every time a gallon of gasoline is sold, a fraction of a penny goes into this trust fund to act as insurance policy to help clean up releases, to help protect drinking water and human health and the environment. So, you know, that's the basis of where the UST regulations come from. And then, you know, from there, people began to implement them. The first rules in 1988, they were given a 10-year window, depending on the age of your tank, for you to implement leak detection, corrosion protection, and spill and overfill protection.
Well, that was a wonderful overview. And as we know, the sensitive part of the whole, you know, the challenge of the USD and assessments are the financial impacts. So can you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, God forbid if your underground storage tank has a release and, you know, the systems, I talked a little bit about how the size of the underground storage tank has increased over time. The way fuel is delivered has also changed. Originally, a lot of the UST systems were suction systems, to where if you can imagine a straw, a pipe went into the underground storage tank, and then the gasoline, the dispenser, applied a suction and actually, you know, pulled gasoline from the underground storage tank to be dispensed from the pump on top of the ground. But those are a little bit slow. And as the size of the stations and the tanks got larger and larger, they put submersible pumps in the underground storage tanks to pressure up and push fuel. So you're looking at probably twice the speed and volume delivery into a vehicle. So that became, you know, more and more desirable. So the initial releases, they may have been a little bit smaller in the beginning. And as we moved into the submersible pumps, when you have a U.S. underground storage tank system failure, the releases become much larger. But, you know, I've read a lot of data, and an average underground storage tank fuel release is typically around 500 gallons. And, you know, on today's, you know, price, if you just factored it, say, you know, $3 a gallon, that's $1,500 of volume of fuel you lost. But then to assess and clean that up, that could cost a few $100,000. So it's very, very expensive, as you pointed out, to clean up these releases. And so that's why these trust funds are put in place, because these UST owners, you know, if they have two or three, you know, significant releases, you know, you're talking edging up to, you know, $750, $1 million to clean up. And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
Absolutely. You know, one thing that we were doing at PPM, which is very sort of innovative, and is how to do the compliance tracking and how to comply with these things, and using a GIS system and a smartphone and all that. And Todd knows that those are very sensitive to make it life easier for the operators. So you want to maybe elaborate on something like that?
Yeah. So, you know, we kind of took it to 1998. And since then, there have been two additional revisions to UST rules. With the 2005 Energy Act, President Bush implemented operator training, to where the people that are on the site that are, you know, operating your underground storage tank system, they have to be trained on how to look for leaks and what to do if there is a spill, overfill, or release of the UST system. There were some additional requirements, too, that stepped up the compliance game. At that point, anything in some states was installed would be double wall from that point forward. And then it evolved into there was a new set of rules in 2015 for your underground storage tanks. And that does bring in the double wall rule and a number of other things to help make sure these UST systems, the releases are not happening. Now, and I'm going to get to some of the technology in just a second. The other thing we've seen, too, is back in the 90s, you would, in a typical state, you would see a few hundred gallon releases a year that were discovered. Now, those numbers tend to be a few dozen, 50, 60. So the numbers have gone down a great bit because of these controls we put in place. But think about technology, Zia, it's gotten really amazing. When you have a double wall system in the interstitial wall. They can have brine, and you can monitor for gasoline entering in that liquid. They can be dry, and then if they have, you know, any kind of moisture comes in, the alarms go off. There are sensors that constantly watch your inventory, and they know when a pump is turned on and you dispense fuel and you dispense 40 gallons, they know that occurred. But they're watching your tank levels to make sure that you're not losing fuel in between the cycles of dispensing fuel. They can also monitor your lines to make sure those don't leak. So there are a lot of ways the technology has come to bear. Now we talked about galvanized fittings that were done in pre-1988 underground storage tanks. Well, now the materials are a special type of plastic or fiberglass, which are resistant to gasoline. They don't corrode. So I guess I should say resistant to corroding. You know, across the board, every area you can think about, there's been technology advances to make the UST system safer and to keep it from releasing.
That's wonderful, Ned. And here's an interesting thought with all the developments and talks about electric vehicles. What are the impacts to the USTs down the road?
You know, that's the next frontier. And when I was watching the Super Bowl just last year, that would be the 2021 Super Bowl, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers versus the Kansas City Chiefs, a really good game. General Motors put a commercial out, and I think I remember they said they will have 26 or 27 models of electric vehicles by the year 2025. In the news, we see a lot of headlines of different counties, areas of the country saying that we do not want combustible fuel by 2035. But I know, and you can see in different areas as you travel, they're still rebuilding and remodeling and putting in new gasoline underground storage tanks. So there will be a change, and the electric vehicle is a very exciting area, and there's a lot of work to, you know, make the batteries better. And I think in the new infrastructure bill that was passed this year in 2021 in Congress, there are billions of dollars laid out to add to the electric grid more and more charging stations, so it's easier to use. So, you know, what we do know, Zia, is all the manufacturers are, you know, building electric vehicles to sell to the consumers, to the public. As more and more of those are purchased, there'll be more and more demand for those, be able to have places to charge them up as you travel and go around. You know, I think it's a very interesting phenomenon because it seems like electric vehicles and self-driving vehicles are kind of traveling together. So it seems like that trend's going to meet a center point. And ultimately, if this nation, if we do convert to more electric vehicles as versus to combustible engines, and that could happen. There's also some other, you know, technologies, you know, liquefied natural gas or hydrogen that could, you know, come to bear, could, you know, upset, disrupt the traditional, you know, gasoline that we're accustomed to. It's going to be really fun to watch that develop. And but ultimately, the C-store is, although it's where we go to buy our fuel, we also go there and we buy a lot of other things. The convenience stores have just become that convenience. And I've seen this year more convenience stores that still operate that don't have gasoline than I've ever seen. And so I think that industry will think through, and I think they will reinvent themselves. And when you stop to charge up your electric vehicle or what other alternative fuel you might be using, I think convenience stores will offer more services to where you can go in and have lunch or do some other things, relax for 20 minutes while everything's, you know, being charged up and fueled. So it's going to be really fun to watch.
Well, thank you so much, Todd. And I think the practicality of, you know, what you're saying in a sort of a layman, you know, terms, you know, really helps to understand the whole picture and the big picture in this business. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely, Zia. Man, you did a great job. I'm kind of worried about my job being the host now, but Zia, thanks for stepping in and guest hosting for us, and there will be more of those. I hope our audience enjoyed it today. So this is Todd Perry signing off. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode of PPM Simplifies. Thank you for finding our podcast. For more information, be sure to visit our website at ppmco.com. To stay updated on new episodes, feel free to subscribe to PPM Simplifies on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, this is PPM Simplifies.